to the special episode of Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast. My name is Ariana Pelosi, and today is July 4th, 2022. In this episode, we revisit the Cancer Network Twitter Spaces podcast that was recorded on the heels of the ASCO annual meeting. We were joined by doctors Paolo Tarantino and Sarah Tolini, both from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, Massachusetts. They spoke about the highlights in breast cancer presented at the annual meeting. Both doctors discussed the practice-changing results from the DESTINY-Breast04 trial and the surprising results from PALOMA-02. Each doctor took a deeper dive into the treatment combinations as well as how they are considering adjusting their practices based on the results presented at the conference. So welcome everybody to our first live podcast. We'll be recapping the recent ASCO meeting. My name is Ariana Pelosi and I'm an assistant editor with Cancer Network and we are the home of the journal Oncology. So today we will be discussing meeting updates in breast cancer with our guests Dr. Tarantino and Dr. Tolini. So Dr. Paolo Tarantino is a clinical research fellow at Dana-Farber and an investigator at the European Institute of Oncology in Milan, Italy. He is joined by Dr. Tolini, the chief of the Division of Breast Oncology and associate director of the Susan F. Smith Center for Women's Cancer at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, as well as an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. So welcome you both.
Oh, thanks so much for having us.
Thank you, Ariana. Very excited to be here.
So just to start off this conversation, can you begin by discussing the DESTINY-Breast04 trial, the results that were observed, and why this was one of the highlights of the conference?
Well, Paolo, I'll let you start because this is, I know, a large area of interest for you.
So yeah, that was really important trial in general for oncology, but specifically for me because I've been focusing on this field of research now for a few years, and meaning the HER2-low breast cancer subtype, which is this emerging entity on which we still don't know enough probably, but it's something that now we're going to need to learn and to adapt to in the next months and years, because we've seen the data from DESTINY-Breast04 that really changed practice. And this was a phase 3 trial randomizing patients with pretreated metastatic breast cancer and with lower HER2 expression, either hormone receptor positive or negative, to receive trastuzumab deruxtecan or chemotherapy of physician choice. There were several choices, including capecitabine, gemcitabine, and taxanes, and eribulin. And the trial showed that both in hormone receptor positive, which was the primary endpoint, and the overall population, there was an improvement in progression-free survival from around 5 to 10 months, and also an improvement in overall survival. And this really tells us that this is a new important option in for pretreated metastatic breast cancer patient with lower HER2 expression, but it also raises important challenges in clinical practice to optimally identify patients with lower HER2 expressions. So Sarah, maybe you can comment on this point.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that was an excellent summary. And, you know, I think these were probably the most exciting data that we saw come out at ASCO, because it really, I think, represents a complete paradigm shift in the way we think about breast cancer therapeutics, because now we're using HER2 as a target and using it as a target to deliver chemotherapy and to achieve, you know, better outcomes for our patients, where we've usually thought of developing drugs more towards oncogenic drivers. And this is very different. Again, it's using purely just a tiny bit of protein expression. It's not that HER2 low cancers have, I don't think, different biology than HER2 zero cancers, but rather, again, just using protein expression. So, you know, I think what we're seeing is very dramatic improvements in PFS in HER2 low disease with T-DXd, really a doubling of PFS, and remarkably a survival benefit at such an early time point is really not something we see. And I thought what also is really, I think, again, very unprecedented is a 50% response rate in hormone receptor positive pretreated breast cancer we never see with chemotherapy. And it's the same response that we saw in the small triple negative subgroup. And so I think, again, this is practice changing. But I think, Paolo, you bring up a lot of excellent questions that these data, you know, now leave us with in terms of practicing. And so I think one that you brought up is a HER2 testing issue. And I know you've done a lot of work in this area in particular. You know, what do you think about how we should be choosing patients for this therapy. Do you think we need a biopsy immediately pre-initiation of therapy to select patients who may have HER2-low expression, or do you think old archival tumor tissue is adequate? And what do you think about the lack of concordance between, for example, 0 and 1 plus staining, and how do you think we should be taking that into account when making decisions for our patients?
These are really important questions that we're going to need to work on in the next months. But for the moment, of course, we need to work with what we have. And what we have is immunohistochemistry. And so what we are seeing is that the way we categorize HER2-low is patient with a tumor scored HER2-1 plus or 2 plus with negative ISH, which is about 50%, 50 to 60% of all breast tumors. But we also know that there is all of this inconsistency and evolution in time. And also, there is not much concordance among pathologists. And the way patients were enrolled in the trial were either if they had a HER2-low expression on a fresh biopsy or on archival type tissue. And so I really think this should be the way we apply the data in clinical practice. And so I would personally think about using this drug for patients that either are at baseline HER2-low or that were in the past HER2-low without necessarily the need for a new biopsy. And this also because we have some reassuring data from DAISY, which was this small phase 2 trial conducted in France and with a lot of translational endpoints, which showed that T-DXd had a 30% response rate even in IHC 0. So I wouldn't be too scared even to treat a patient if it has HER2 1 plus, 2 plus at certain point and 0 at another point. And so it's something we're going to need to study a lot, but I really think that we're going to need also new assays. And there are several quantitative assays that are being studied, have been studied in these years and will be studied. And I really think we're going to need to adapt to a new way of quantifying low expressions of HER2. And these are not only true for HER2, because there were other very interesting results presented with other ADCs at this Congress. And one highlight, for instance, was the TROPiCS-02 study, phase 3 study. And maybe you can comment on that, Sarah.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. I think all these ADCs are exciting to have. So the TROPiCS-02 study was a randomized phase 3 trial that was looking at the benefits of sacituzumab in very heavily pretreated metastatic hormone receptor positive disease. So it was for patients who had received prior CDK4/6 inhibition, prior endocrine therapy, and had a minimum of 2 lines of chemotherapy in the metastatic setting and no more than 4. And patients were then randomized to get sacituzumab or treatment of physician's choice chemotherapy. And what we saw was that the study did meet its primary endpoint. So sacituzumab was associated with an improvement in progression-free survival relative to standard chemotherapy, going from about 4 months to 5.5 months. So about a 1.5-month delta in terms of PFS. At this time point, which was an interim time point, the overall survival events were not yet mature, and so there was not a statistically significant difference in overall survival, though a very small numerical trend at this time point. And so I think overall what it's suggesting is that sacituzumab is performing better than chemotherapy. I think there are some who felt that, you know, maybe this difference in progression-free survival, you know, is not large. And so I think people were questioning, is this really clinically meaningful to make a change in our standard practice? And I think the way I would put it into perspective, though, is that this is a very heavily pretreated group of patients. It's a median of 3 lines of chemotherapy in the metastatic setting. And what we're seeing is that standard chemo does not perform very well, as I think we all clinically know. You know, usually getting 4-month PFS in this setting is, you know, ambitious. And so having another agent that can perform better, I think, is really an area of unmet need. And I think the other thing I would take into account is that, you know, when you look at landmark analyses in these trials, you do see that it was substantially better at the 6- and 12-month time point with sacituzumab relative to chemo, sort of suggesting that in this pretreated population, there are those people who kind of drop off quickly, those people who progress on the first or second restaging scan, but then those who make it beyond can do significantly better with SASE compared to chemo. So, you know, it would be nice to have another option for patients, again, knowing how poorly they do perform in this very pretreated setting. But Paolo, I'll turn it back to you. What did you think of the sacituzumab data, and particularly in light of DESTINY-Breast04, how would you put it into perspective?
Well, this is very interesting because I think many of us are tempted to assess, to test the expression of the marker of these ADCs. But for the moment, we are left with cross-trials comparison. And one setting where there's few questions because you cannot use T-DXd is patient with HER2-0 disease that always was HER2-0. And so in these patients, definitely, I would prioritize sacituzumab, of course, because you cannot use T-DXd. And in general, for hormone receptor positive patients, since T-DXd was tested in an earlier line, I think if a patient is HER2 low, you might think of using it right after one or two lines of chemotherapy, and sacituzumab might be used afterwards. And something that we really have to understand here is mechanisms of resistance. And there was a very nice paper published on Cancer Discovery suggesting that it is complicated, meaning that resistance mechanism may be related to the payload or to the targeted antigen. And so we really need to understand so much more to optimally sequence these agents in the clinic. And in triple negative, it's more complicated. So also in triple negative disease, most of the patients are HER2-0, are not HER2-low. And so in these cases, you wouldn't be able to use T-DXd, and you would definitely use sacituzumab. But even for patients that are HER2-low, we really have strong data with sacituzumab in the ESSEN trial with a doubling of survival. So in this case, I would probably prioritize sacituzumab, although, of course, it's tempting because despite there were very few patients in DESTINY-04 with triple negative disease, there was a very interesting PFS and OS benefit. So in general, I think it's great that we're having so many new options. And just to close the chapter of ADCs, I would just add another option that is more on the horizon rather than here, which was patritumab deruxtecan. There was a very nice presentation of this anti-HER3 ADC, and maybe you can comment if you found those data interesting.
Yeah, no, it is nice that there are all these ADCs. And I think, so this patritumab deruxtecan is a HER3 ADC. So it's actually very much like T-DXd in that it has a deruxtecan payload, but instead is targeting HER3. And we saw data with this agent really in a phase one setting. So it was looking at a couple of different dose levels in patients who, for hormone receptor positive disease, could have had low or high HER3 expression. And then we also saw cohorts in the HER2 positive and triple negative setting. And, you know, I will say I thought the data were very interesting because you are seeing significant responses in all three subtypes of disease. And so there are toxicities with the drug, though they did see issues with some thrombocytopenia as well as elevated liver enzymes. And so they're going to explore a more intermediate dose between the two doses that were presented at ASCO. And so we'll see certainly more data to come. But I think it's going to leave us with this question of, you know, if patritumab deruxtecan pans out and continues to look very good at other dose levels, how are we going to then think of developing all these ADCs, and how can these drugs work sequentially one after the other? You know, there are also other ADCs in development like Dato-DXd, which also has a deruxtecan payload. And so if we end up with all these ADCs like T-DXd, sacituzumab, you know, patritumab, deruxtecan, all of these sequentially, how are we going to think about utilizing them? And I think, Paolo, you brought up an excellent point, is that we need to better understand mechanisms of sensitivity and resistance. And in truth, I think we really don't at this point in time. And so we have no clue really how these are going to function sequentially. We have a little hint from some data that was presented looking at Dato-DXd that did include some patients who had had prior sacituzumab. So, you know, really interesting because sacituzumab also has a topo-1 payload, and then you're using Dato after that, and that agent has deruxtecan, which is also a topo-1 payload. And you're seeing that there were patients who actually did have reduction in tumor size who went sequentially from sacituzumab to Dato. And so while the response rate was overall lower in people with prior topo-1 ADCs, I think it still suggests that there are patients who are deriving benefit, which I think just goes to show how clueless we are, because those drugs are really both targeting TROP2 and have very similar payloads. So I think, again, we'll have a lot to learn, but very exciting to see so many new agents coming along, which is great. But maybe maybe we could shift gears a little bit, moving a little bit away from ADCs and maybe going to CDK4/6 inhibition, which certainly now we've had around for quite a while, but we've been eagerly awaiting survival data from Paloma-2, because we had survival data from the Mona Lisa studies, including Mona Lisa 2, Mona Lisa 7, Mona Lisa 3. We've yet to see the first-line survival data with abemaciclib in Monarch 3, but we do have survival data in Monarch 2 that's been presented. But again, I think everyone was eager to see these survival data now mature from Paloma-2. But I don't know, Paolo, if you want to give us your impressions of the data and what you think this may have implications for our clinical practice.
Well, so I think it's fair, after talking about so many good news, to also give the bad news that came. And Paloma really, I think, came slightly unexpected, because we have seen that with all of the CDK4/6 inhibitors, there was a consistent PFS benefit. And in Paloma, PFS was the primary endpoint, but still you would have expected some improvement, at least numeric improvement of overall survival. And we did not see this. There was really a very similar overall survival with a median of 51 to 54 months, but in general, not really comparing favorably with the data from first line Ribo and Abema. And of course, this makes a lot of discussion emerge, because Palbo has been used a lot in the clinic. It's a very well-tolerated agent we've been using for a long time. But now we really have strong data with Ribo and Abema. And with Abema, we also have good data in the adjuvant setting. It's in the last year or so, it really changed practice in the adjuvant setting, whereas Palbo has two negative phase 3 trial. And so, of course, we started discussing again of the different structure of these three CDK4/6 inhibitors. And so I really think there it's worth to rediscuss the strategies and to think if we can still discuss about using a different CDK4/6 inhibitor compared to palbociclib. And now it's not only Paloma that enters in this discussion, because we also saw some intriguing data from Mantaine suggesting that also keeping CDK4/6 inhibition at progression might be a good strategy and might improve outcomes in patients. What did you think of Mantaine, Sarah?
Yeah, well, I think there was a lot of very exciting things coming out about CDK4/6. I think specifically for Mantaine, I will say, first of all, you know, congratulations to Kevin Kalinske and his team on that, because it's very challenging to run a randomized phase 2 as an investigator-initiated study, and to get that done, you know, is a tremendous amount of work. So it was really nice to see, which is really, you know, our first randomized data looking at this question of continuation of CDK4/6 inhibition beyond progression. In this particular case, though, the majority of people had first-line CDK with palbociclib. You know, over 80% of them had palbo as their first exposure. And then the trial was really looking at switching the endocrine backbone. So going, you know, if you were on an AI to go to fulvestrant, if you were on fulvestrant to go to an AI, and then using ribociclib in combination. So you got your endocrine therapy with ribo or your endocrine therapy alone. And what we saw was really a significant improvement in progression-free survival from the use of continued CDK4/6 inhibition. So, you know, really with the use of ribociclib here. And, you know, I think this was very intriguing. It's a randomized phase 2. And so I don't think it's a definitive practice-changing trial. But I'll be honest, I think in truth, it's been confirming what many people were doing clinically, right? I think there were patients for whom were getting first-line endocrine therapy and CDK. And when we saw cases of people who had just minimal progression, we felt sort of bad to completely change routes on them, and we would continue a CDK4/6 inhibitor. And in truth, I think many people were sequencing from upfront palbo to using abema in a second-line approach. And we've now seen case series looking at this type of sequencing suggesting benefit, and now we have a randomized study suggesting benefit. But I think the thing that I would be cautious about is that I think we need to understand patient selection for this strategy better, because, you know, in truth, the standard of care is to take someone who progresses on a CDK4/6 and get genomic testing if they have a PI3 kinase mutation to think about endocrine therapy with alpelisib. You know, if you look at the BELIEVE data, you'll see that the PFS in a post-CDK setting is longer than what we're seeing, for example, in MAINTAIN. And so, you know, I really think that that should be the standard in a PIK3CA mutant patient. But I think this comes up a lot when we get the PI3K wild type patients, is what do you do for them? I think many of us were often offering everolimus in combination with endocrine therapy or thinking about this continuation of CDK4/6. But, you know, I think we're going to have to personalize this approach. I think we need to have genomics to understand, you know, which patients have mutations that may lead you to think they have CDK4/6 resistance, like RB mutation, for example, where you wouldn't want to think about this approach. And, you know, Kevin presented some really interesting data looking at mutational status with ESR1 and suggested that maybe those patients didn't benefit from this continuation approach. But I would be cautious with using those data definitively, because it was small numbers, and the patients with ESR1 mutations tended to also have other alterations, so more FGFR amplification, for example, so other alterations that could lead to CDK4/6 resistance. So I think the jury's out on, you know, if ESR1 mutant patients aren't benefiting from this strategy. I think we need more data, but really interesting. But I think it also kind of circles back to the PALOMA-2 data is, you know, what does this data mean if we potentially may be changing our first line approach? You know, obviously in MAINTAIN, most people are getting first line palbo. I mean, I think, Paolo, I think this kind of comes up now is, do we really necessarily need to change our first line approach? And I think the reason I think this is an important question is that palbo is really well tolerated, right? Our patients do very well on it. We obviously have many patients who've been on it for years. The PFS benefit was identical with the three agents. We also saw there were some challenges with PALOMA-2, right? There was a lot of, over 20% of patients didn't have survival data. Many patients withdrew consent from the trial around the time of PALBO approval. We also saw crossover. You know, we know that the short disease-free interval patients were included in this trial, whereas they weren't included in other studies. So differences in patient populations. Should we definitively take this to mean we shouldn't be using palbociclib? I think that's really the question. And I'll be honest, I find it a challenging one to answer. I think it more comes from the totality of the data, as you were suggesting, that's making us a little bit anxious that we didn't see survival in PALOMA-3, we didn't see benefit in PALLAS or PENELOPE-B. But, you know, I think we have some sense that this drug does work in endocrine-sensitive patients. And so I think we have to be cautious about making sort of definitive conclusions, but I don't know how you feel.
No, absolutely, I agree. And I think an important piece of data, we might need to wait a little, but since I see that there is Thomas Pasquale connected, and there is a very interesting trial that, like, there is being led by Salty, which is the Harmonia trial, which is going to compare ribociclib to palbociclib. And that might tell us, it's not in all the patients, it's in some biomarker-selected patients, but still, it might tell us if these drugs have a different activity. And then there's so much more coming, so many new CDK2 selective or CDK246 inhibitors. And so I really think there's going to be a lot of evolution in the coming years. But yeah, for the moment, it's very hard to derive definitive conclusions from the data that we've seen at ASCO. At the same time, I think there's going to be a lot of discussion and in this field. And I think we can move on to some other interesting data also were presented. I don't know if there was anything else that really drew your attention. To me, it was a good news to see that in the DESTINY-Breast03 trial of T-DXd, there was a very similar interstitial lung disease rate compared to prior data that we had. And also in DESTINY-Breast04, although there were three cases that were grade 5, the rate of grade 5 events seems to be reducing in time, and this might be because we're learning how to detect and treat this toxicity better. I don't know how you feel about this side effect.
Yeah, and it was really nice to see, I agree, the updated safety data from DESTINY-Breast03 and not see any more, really not see any high-grade ILD events in that trial, even with longer follow-up. You know, obviously, with DESTINY-Breast04, we did see those three grade 5 events. And, you know, I think it really just is a reminder to us that ILD is an issue with T-DXd, and we do have to be mindful of it and be cautious about monitoring patients. And, you know, I think it brings up the question of what is the ideal way to monitor patients for ILD? Because in truth, I don't think we know. All we know is that on the DESTINY trials, they were really mandating every 6 week high-res CTs, which one could argue may be a nice way to pick up the sort of low-grade asymptomatic ILDs. And, you know, in my head, I think, well, maybe I'm going to prevent a higher grade ILD event by catching it early. But the honest truth is we don't know that. And, you know, we also don't know if other modalities of testing like PFTs, for example, would be helpful in catching potential early changes. So, you know, I think we need to learn a lot more here, and we need to continue to remain cautious with monitoring patients for ILD and to really follow the ILD guidelines, you know, discontinue TDXD for grade 2 or high ILD and hold with grade 1 and just be cautious. But I thought the other interesting thing about DB03 was the data presented on nausea, because, you know, those trials didn't have mandatory prophylactic antiemetics at the beginning, but I think we've all learned how critical that is. I don't know, Paolo, if you want to comment on that.
Absolutely. Like, we, in the beginning, there was a lot of stress about many side effects, but I think that when this drug was implemented in the clinic, what we really saw is that there is a need to manage nausea and vomit in a best possible way. And we are learning that this drug is at least moderately emetogenic, and so it deserves at least to be to receive a prophylaxis with two agents, and sometimes it needs to be escalated to three agents in order to really achieve an optimal control. And many times we also see that there is a delayed nausea and vomit with this drug, because ADCs can have a long cinetic, can remain circulating for days. So, and so we really need to be sure to cover nausea and vomit, and to prepare also patients to have drugs to be used in case they were needed, even after days, even after 1 week or 10 days. And this might be really one of the most important side effects to be carefully checked and to be carefully managed in a clinic with TDXD, especially now that we expect that its use is going to expand to any breast cancer subtype. And in the future, since we're going to see the data from DESTINY-Breast06, where also patients with IHC 0 were included, we might think that this drug might expand its reach even to a larger population of patients. So it becomes really critical, as you said, to learn how to best manage and detect ILD. And so I think education is very important. All the providers should really be aware of this potential side effect, and also gastrointestinal side effects, of course. And then something that was intriguing to me, and I cannot say I really found an explanation for this, but maybe you did, and it was the RCB data from KEYNOTE-522, where most of the benefit was seen of the addition of pembrolizumab to the neoadjuvant chemotherapy in TNBC was in the RCB2. So what was your explanation of this finding?
Yeah, I'm not sure I have a very good answer either. I think it was really interesting, though, because, I mean, I think certainly, you know, one message, I think there are a few different messages I took away from that 522 presentation. One, the delta in PCR was actually pretty small in KEYNOTE-522, right? You know, it was a little under about 7% or so. And so yet that smallish PCR delta is translating into very large improvements in event-free survival. And so I think it tells us that the relationship between PCR and EFS is different with immunotherapy-based preoperative therapy compared to what we've previously seen with chemo alone in a pre-op setting. So I think important to realize that we can see long-term impact from that exposure of treatment. But I think the other thing that, you know, was presented was really the shift in RCB that we're sort of seeing, you know, across all RCB levels, with the exception really of RCB3 patients, we see the shift in RCB where people are coming to a lower RCB from exposure to Pembro, which I think is important. But yet what you're also, you know, discussing is that if you look at the absolute benefits in patients by RCB, you really see no benefit in RCB3 patients, but you do see very large benefits in larger than the other, than RCB1 in RCB2 patients. So why would that be? You know, it's hard because the numbers start getting smaller as you divide people out into these groups. And so was it a numbers game or is this really biologically true? And I don't, you know, honestly know the answer to that. But it's interesting that there is this group of people, these RCB3 people, where they're really not benefiting from much. And so these, I think, are patients we need to sort out because these are the patients that we see that have such refractory disease that we need better therapeutic options for. The one thing I will say is that I didn't quite understand in the conclusion was that they did suggest that maybe the benefits that they're seeing were related to the adjuvant portion of therapy. But I'll say I don't think that you could conclude that in this trial because certainly the pre-op portion can lead to these this impact on event-free survival. And so I think we still don't really understand what component of therapy is driving. Portion is probably, you know, the most important part of the treatment paradigm. But again, very intriguing data that we saw. So I'll say overall, I thought it was a fabulous ASCO with so much really interesting data that came out, including, you know, with immunotherapy. The NeoPACT study I thought was also really interesting. It was a single arm trial looking at docetaxel carboplatin pembro, but showed almost a 60% PCR rate. And, you know, outstanding, you know, 80% 2-year long-term outcomes in terms of disease-free survival. So, you know, I think we still need to learn which patients need all this chemo that we're giving in the pre-op setting. Does everyone need anthracycline, taxane, platinum in addition to the checkpoint? And so I think that was an intriguing trial, and hopefully we'll get more data in a phase 3 setting to understand how it compares to 522. But, you know, I think maybe it'd be nice to open the floor to questions and see what other questions people may have.
As a reminder for questions, you can go to our homepage, and this is pinned at the top of our profile, and you can comment below, or you can request to speak with the request button being located underneath the microphone.
And so while we wait for questions, since we have been talking about science up to now, I will move a little bit outside of science and talk more about feelings, because it was a really beautiful feeling to see the standing ovation during Death in Breast 04. And I heard that the last time this happened, unfortunately, I was not there, but it was at the presentation of the adjuvant data of trastuzumab. And I don't know, Sarah, if you have any memory of that, but that was a really special moment. It made me feel really that something is changing and that we are expanding the reach of NTR2 treatments to a larger population of patients. So were you there when they presented the adjuvant trastuzumab data?
I was not present for that presentation, but you know, certainly it's the one that everyone has always talked about, really being a complete shift in outcomes for our patients. And you know, it was nice to be able to see everyone appreciate the DESTINY-Breast04 data and the implications that it has for patients. And I think it really also begs the question is, how can we move this drug even earlier? How can we get it to early disease patients to really increase the cure rate? And I think that potential is what's making everyone really so excited, because maybe this can really also be a game changer for early disease patients.
Absolutely agree. And you, since you were mentioning about adapting, tailoring treatments in the early setting, I think an interesting piece of data was presented by Marla Lipsick-Scharf from Dana-Farber. She's a fellow here, and she presented some data with liquid biopsy, with ctDNA tracking, which really showed that patients that have ctDNA detectable also after 5 years of after the surgery for an HR-positive tumor, they have a very high risk for relapse. And so I wanted to ask you if you think that there is a future for adapting treatment strategies based on ctDNA or other liquid biopsy strategies, similarly to what we have seen in colorectal cancer. There was the New England paper published for ctDNA tracking in colorectal cancer, and I feel that we are a little bit ahead, but that shows us a little bit what's ahead of us, what's on the horizon. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think, first of all, I was very excited and proud of the data that Marla and our colleague Heather Parsons presented at ASCO. I think they did a great job, really. You know, it's the first data that we have to understand the prevalence of detecting ctDNA in patients in a late adjuvant hormone receptor positive setting. So important to see the prevalence is, you know, really only about 10%. I'll be honest, I didn't know what it would be. And so really interesting to understand that. But I think the other thing that came out was that, you know, of the eight patients who had detectable ctDNA, six of them recurred, you know, with a median lean time of about 12 months. But I think the challenge with the data is that patients weren't scanned at the time of detection of ctDNA. So you don't really know what the true lead time is. And I think my fear is that if these people actually had metastatic disease at the time of detection of ctDNA, that wouldn't leave us with a window to intervene and prevent recurrence. And so I think we really need to understand this better, and we need to know if this is going to have implications for us to be able to really impact patients and be able to intervene and prevent recurrences. So, you know, it's really a first step in trying to understand this, which I think is tremendous, and hopefully it will lead us to be able to change outcomes for people. And there are planned studies trying to look at this strategy as a way to intervene. So hopefully we'll see more to come.
So I have not seen any questions come through, but I do have a question regarding Paloma 2. So as we saw, the OS results in Paloma 2 failed to show a significant difference in survival with palbociclib. So how should clinicians apply these data to their practice?
I think, I'll be honest, I think it's a tough one because, you know, if you have a patient sitting in front of you, you obviously want to offer them the drug that has the largest impact on their life, right? And that's going to improve their outcomes. And, you know, we don't have head-to-head data to know which one is truly the best CDK4/6 inhibitor. But, you know, when you put trials side by side, you know, you do see that MONALEESA 2, MONALEESA 7, and MONALEESA 3 all had patients in a first-line setting that had survival benefit that was statistically significant. And we don't yet have the first-line data from abemaciclib. And so I think when you're prescribing a new agent, I do think many prescribers are now going to be a little tempted to use ribociclib instead of palbociclib. And I think that's certainly reasonable to do. I don't think prescribing palbociclib is wrong. We know it has you know, identical progression-free survival. And in truth, I think it's probably the easiest of the three CDK4/6 inhibitors from a tolerability standpoint. You know, with ribociclib, you do have to make sure you monitor QTC. You do have to think about medications that can prolong QTC. So there is a little bit that you have to consider. But if a patient is a candidate for both, I think likely most people are going to prescribe ribociclib. I would not, however, take someone who's on first-line therapy with endocrine therapy and palbociclib and switch them to ribociclib, because these are patients who are benefiting from their treatment at this time, and there would not be an indication to change their current treatment.
I agree. And since we jump back to CDK4/6 inhibitors, I think we could also discuss about the new MONARCHY data that you presented, Sarah, and that I think really helped to understand how to use this new treatment option in the adjuvant setting, because there is a significant benefit in DFS with this drug, so it can be really helpful in a high-risk setting. But we also know that discontinuation rates are also need to be improved. We need to improve the way we use this drug in clinical practice, understand where is the highest risk of discontinuation, how to manage that. And I just wanted one comment from you about this.
Yeah, no, thanks, Paolo. So, you know, as we know, MONARCHY was the trial that looked at using 2 years of adjuvant abemaciclib in combination with endocrine therapy compared to endocrine therapy alone. And our in our very high-risk hormone receptor-positive patients in the adjuvant setting and found, you know, about a 30% reduction in IDFS events from using the 2 years of abemaciclib. But as you point out, you know, there was about a 25% rate of discontinuation of abemaciclib prior to getting to that 2 year mark of treatment. And most of the discontinuation actually occurs very early in treatment, usually actually just in the first few months. And I think one challenge was in the trial, there were many patients who even discontinued within the first month, despite not even attempting any dose modification. And so, you know, I think obviously it was at a time when people didn't know that the drug was providing benefit. And so thresholds for discontinuation obviously were quite different. But this analysis that we presented at ASCO was really to look at clinical factors that would help you predict which patients may have early discontinuation to therapy. And I think many of the factors that actually came out from the multivariate analysis actually were things that many of us would predict. So having a poor performance status, having multiple comorbidities, being of older age, these are things that, you know, I think many of us would think of as qualities that may make tolerability to agents a little bit more challenging. Some of the things I think were intriguing because we found that people who had 1 to 3 positive nodes compared to the 4 or more positive node patients were more likely to have early discontinuation. And I think to me, this just suggests that people who have lower risk disease, relatively speaking, you know, may have a lower threshold to discontinue, whereas people at very high risk sort of push through therapies, maybe more so because of the concern for risk of recurrence. And so maybe that's partially influencing, you know, tolerability of drugs. And so I think we still have a lot to learn, and I think we need to figure out how to incorporate this data into our practice. You know, if someone has multiple risk factors for early discontinuation, what are you going to do differently? Obviously, you still need to monitor these people. You need to make sure that at the, you know, onset of any particularly GI toxicities that you can be available to help them with use of supportive measures such as antidiarrheal therapies, dose holds, and dose modifications as needed, because I think those strategies really make a big difference. But I think it also calls into question if we need to think about other strategies, things like dose escalation or other ways to help make treatment more tolerable. So, you know, I think it was nice to have these data and really, again, just supports the need to have careful monitoring of people.
Totally agree. And yes, I think we are much beyond time, so I don't know if Ariane and you can be here. But in general, I just wanted to comment, even just to the fact of being back together. It was the first ASCO in person after a long time of having it as virtual experience. And personally, I really felt that networking in person made a big difference. And it was really good to see that we could do that, that most of the people were wearing masks. It was safe. It was a great opportunity to see a lot of important data. And it was a good experience. And I really hope that the same is going to happen also at ESMO in Paris and in San Antonio. And I really look forward to participating to these other meetings.
Oh, thank you, Paolo. I agree. It was really exciting. It's my first meeting back in person in a couple years. And so it was definitely a wonderful experience, especially to be able to witness the standing ovation for DESTINY-Breast04. So a great meeting overall. And thank you all for joining us today. We really appreciate it. It's a great way to be able to cover ASCO. And so thank you for joining.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter @cancernetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn @cancernetwork.